From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Rick Perlstein is my guest. He's the author of Nixonland, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America, which is now in paperback. It's not a biography of Nixon, but a history of the 60s with an attitude. Rick Perlstein, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hey, Gary.
So a couple of months ago, all the Beatles albums were re-released in remastered versions, and they shot up the charts. And here was music that had been recorded 40 years ago, but it still sounded very contemporary. Although 40 years ago, you know, if you put music on that had been recorded 40 years earlier or even, you know, 10 years earlier, it would have sounded like an antique. Now, the politics of Richard Nixon, as I'm reading them in your book, they seem very contemporary. Is Nixon the Beatles of politics?
I kind of like that analogy. I mean, the way it works for me is that the 60s were the crucible upon which sort of so much of how we understand the world today was formed. And by understand the world, I mean argue about the world, the battle lines, as it were. So, you know, just like the Beatles, you know, kind of set the horizon for what a rock band is and what a rock band does, in ways that are, you know, still being revealed to us, you know, repeated listening. Nixon kind of gave us the stories that, for good or ill, are still the ones we argue about in American politics. I mean, the red versus blue, the, you know, Barack Obama versus Sarah Palin, left versus right, heartland versus coast, all that sort of stuff.
What's interesting is that the period that you write about, it felt, I mean, now you're a person who has no idea what it felt like, because I think you're probably the first chronicler of Nixon not to have been an adult or even really alive during most of his reign.
I was born in September 3rd of 1969.
So, the thing about it at the time was that the revolution, there was a revolution taking place, but it was the opposite revolution than the one we thought was taking place.
Right. Well, when I was an editor at a magazine called Lingua Franca in the 1990s, that we wrote a lot about sort of debates that were going on in academia, I wrote a big article called Who Owns the 60s, in which I basically chronicled the fact that scholars who were writing about the 1960s who were born after the baby boom, in other words, scholars of my generation, were coming up with a completely different optic on the situation. And one of the ways they were seeing things was, well, this wasn't really the decade of Tom Hayden and, you know, Abbie Hoffman and the Berrigan brothers and Stokely Carmichael, so much as those guys were the seedbed for the rise of Nixon and Reagan and Newt Gingrich. And that turned out to be, you know, it's a complicated story. There's you know, lots of legacies, but one of the most important legacies and one of the most neglected legacies was how the 60s really kind of became the seedbed for the rise of the contemporary right.
And did Nixon know what he was doing, do you think?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I mean, great leaders, and by the word great, I don't mean, you know, desirable or lovable. I mean sort of people who shape history and shape you know, the world using their awesome and enormous will, are the kind of people, they kind of surf the waves of history as they find them, but they also kind of shape the wave. And Richard Nixon stumbled into even that approach to politics in the 1960s. I would argue that, of course, you know, my book kind of starts with Goldwater, you know, losing the biggest landslide in American history in 1964, Lyndon Johnson winning, and this was, you know, my book Nixonland is a sequel to a book that I wrote called Before the Storm on Barry Goldwater, and that book ends with this big landslide and all the pundits declaring that the right-wing backlash was a failure, that it was never going to see another day in American political life, that if the Republicans wanted to get back into the catbird seat, they had to purge all the conservatives, purge all this anti-liberal resentment, right?
And isn't that what people are saying? That's almost exactly what people are saying now.
Yeah, well, we could go into that too.
Yeah.
And then in, you know, 1965, the year of the Watts riots, suddenly things began looking very different. And in 1966, the Republicans kind of back into sort of control of the discourse in electoral politics, at least, by winning back 47 seats on this very kind of backlash, anti-civil rights, anti-hippie kind of platform. And had that 1966 election not unfolded exactly as it had, you know, I think Richard Nixon in 1968 probably would have ran as a Republican liberal. You know, he was just this opportunistic guy who was sticking his finger in the wind and, you know, basically picking up people's hopes and fears and dreams as he found them. Now, on the other hand, if he had run as a Republican liberal in 1968, he might not have won because that was not his natural register. He was especially equipped because of sort of the circumstances and upbringing of his life to kind of speak to people's resentments because of the social changes on the left in the 1960s in very convincing and very galvanizing ways, and also in kind of ways that were very non-threatening to people who were afraid of being called racist because they were backlashing against civil rights and liberalism. So the man found its movement, but you know the movement also shaped the man.
Well, there's a phrase that you used to describe him, which it feels very familiar when thinking about today's, you know, kind of ever-growing voice against President Obama and talk radio and all that crap. The tangle of rage and piety.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't no one's pulled it out before, but I think that it really that's the kind of image that really sticks to our ribs, right, here in 2009. It's the rage, it's the piety. People kind of undergird their rage with this kind of patina of piety, and the piety is almost a cover for the rage, right? I mean, the people who are the most religious seem to be, you know, feel to a lot of us to be sort of the most unchristian, the most kind of ungracious in sort of absorbing change, absorbing people who are different from them. And that certainly was kind of the emotional register that Richard Nixon absolutely mastered. It was his own, that's where he lived, you know, kind of in his own head. But he also basically played to people's tangle of rage and piety, too. Because this is a guy, you can't forget, one of the most shocking things about when the Nixon tapes were released in, you know, basically late 1973, 1974, was that this guy had a foul mouth. This guy swore. Because up to that point, he was seen as Mr. Straight-Laced, you know, Mr. Pious, the guy who would never swear in public, the guy who, you know, was, you know, the white picket fence guy in front of the fireplace. But, you know, one of the things I try and do in Nixon land is show that, you know, the rage and the piety were two sides of the same coin, and that sort of the one sort of formed the other in a way that's, you know, really recognizable to us in a time when, for example, Sarah Palin's latest crusade is that supposedly the emblem "In God We Trust" in the new coins is further off center in the layout of the coins that it used to be. So, you know, that's evidence of a liberal plot to defy popular religion. And, you know, there it is. You know, we've come full circle. Or we've come half circle, or even exactly the same place.
Oh, we haven't moved at all. That's right. We're still in the middle of the circle. Well, the thing is, when you get to the sort of the last third of your book, when the tapes, I guess, became a larger source for your...
Yeah, they become a source, so I can, you know what was going on behind the walls of the White House and kind of become a fly on the wall.
And we not only hear him cursing in extremely foul language, but often attached to anti-Semitic or racist... remarks.
Yeah, there's a great quote in which he from even not necessarily from the tapes. I think in Haldeman's diary, he's like, "Oh, the old man is going on and on about his pet theories about the levels of civilization and how, you know, the Caucasoid and the Mongoloid and the da 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 da." So, you know, that's a very fascinating sort of benchmark for figuring out Richard Nixon, because you know, he was so ideologically pliable. You know, he was a civil rights advocate in the Republican Party in the 1950s, because that's kind of where it was at in the Republican Party. And he, you know, very, very sort of, you know, plastic, with great plasticity, was able to become an anti-civil rights voice in the late 60s. But, you know, so what did he really believe? Well, he believed that black people were inferior. You know, that's kind of what he held in his heart of hearts. So, you know, I mean, I see the book as kind of a prism, and the light looks different, you know, depending from which way the angle of vision strikes.
Well, you It's a book that has so many little things that you bring in. You're constantly bringing in. I mean, you just made me think of when you quote John Wayne in his Playboy interview saying that...
Oh, yeah, the Indians had it coming.
And that he's that he believes in white supremacy until blacks are, I don't know...
Raised to the level of civilization.
Right.
Yeah, and so, like, that actually is a good example, because you wonder, well, was John Wayne... the most popular star in America in the 50s and 60s, and this kind of touchstone of the culture of rage and piety, despite this kind of anger he kind of carried barely beneath the surface and only came out in this, very, very sort of rare moment in this one interview, or was it because of it? Did people kind of read off, kind of John Wayne's affect, the same kind of sort of rage that they were feeling? And that's really how Richard Nixon functioned. This whole idea that his supporters were in a silent majority, that he was going to give you the voice to kind of articulate these kind of half-formed rages that just kind of you didn't really have any kind of public language to express.
Well, what does it say about education? In that, John Wayne was an actor and not a particularly well-educated one, but Nixon was an educated man, a lawyer, and...
Well, that's a pretty interesting thing, because one of the kind of parts of the tangle of rage and piety that kind of underwrites backlash politics is a very fascinating strain of kind of intellectual defensiveness and anxiety. So Nixon was this really smart guy. In fact, he was probably the smartest guy in his high school, which is why he got a scholarship to Harvard. But he also was, his family didn't have, his family didn't have the means to send him to Harvard to, sort of pay for his room and board, so he had to go to the kind of local college, Whittier College. So he kind of bore that resentment with him all his life, that basically the world was run by these guys who went to Harvard who weren't as smart as him, right? And that sort of, the idea that these liberal elites are trying to pull one over on people and claim that they're smarter, but they're not really smarter. That was one of Agnew's riffs. He'd always, talk about these so-called intellectuals. Is still very much part of, right-wing resentment culture. When I get, hate mail from right-wing folks, it's always, well, you think you're so smart, I'm smarter than you. Do you want to debate me on the issues? And then my favorite one was, do you want to debate me on the issues? And then the next sentence was, I didn't think so. Chicken or something like that. So, that kind of incredibly thin skin towards the issue of sort of cognitive accomplishment is, one of the ways that right-wing politics plays itself out in a society where basically, a cognitive elite more or less runs things. And there's not really, sort of doesn't seem like there's much place in the world for people who not only people who aren't smart, but people who don't seem to have the trappings of being smart.
We're talking with Rick Perlstein, and he's the author of Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America, and also the author of Barry Goldwater, Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus. And he's also a nattering nabob of negativism, which is why he gets so much hate mail. Do you get a lot of hate mail?
Well, I actually had a run-in with Mr. O'Reilly a couple months ago.
Oh, you were on the show, or what?
I was not on the show, actually. I wrote an article about how Republicans were divided, kind of Republican intellectuals, the kind of people who were kind of trying to occupy the role that William F. Buckley, occupied, for so many years before he died, how divided they were in the question of Sarah Palin. And some considered her the great white hope who was going to lead us out of the wilderness, and some people consider her this giant embarrassment. And, I quoted all kinds of conservative intellectuals, saying terrible things about Sarah Palin. And next thing I know, the next day I open my kind of public email box, and there's all this hate mail. I mean, absolutely violent, scabrous stuff, complaining about my supposed sexual preferences and my ethnicity and that sort of thing. And I said, what the hell happened? Well, it turned out that Bill O'Reilly had done a feature about this article, claiming that this was just another, sort of nattering nabob of negativism, just another, liberal pinheaded intellectual taking the chance to insult Sarah Palin. And, you know, he completely got the article wrong, but he's got these legions of people who, you know, treat what he says as gospel. So that was a week in which, you know, I got, like, you know, in the 2 hours that that aired at, like, you know, whatever, 8 o'clock, I got, like, you know, 20 pieces of hate mail. And then 2 hours later, when it reran at 10 o'clock, I got, you know, another 20 pieces of hate mail. And so I immediately, you know, emailed him and emailed their producers and said, well, this is my address if you want to send your, you know, producer out, you know, to stalk me. And and that was a lot of fun.
Now, your book definitely has, you know, an attitude. I mean, I think it's different than any history that's been written before. I mean, I would say it's different than any history that's been written before. I mean, you have sarcasm in your book, which is...
Oh, brother, you don't read enough history.
Is there a lot of sarcasm?
Well, I mean, my hero is someone like Gary Wills, who,
right,
you know, mm-hmm, definitely
an early,
you know, has a hell of a lot of attitude, too.
Yeah. But, of course, when he was writing about Nixon, it was definitely...
He wrote about Nixon, you know, sort of during the Nixon administration.
Right.
But, you know, he writes all kinds of history. I mean, I think history could be a... My hope is that it can be sort of a searching kind of moral inquiry without sacrificing fairness and accuracy, and that it actually can have a point of view and an attitude, and that, you know, people of all different sorts of ideological persuasions can derive value from it, even though the author himself, and certainly in my case, you know, might portray, you know, an ideological point of view.
Mm-hmm. And, well, although your portrait of Nixon is not particularly kind, I mean, you do think that Nixon had a sincere belief, even if those beliefs were wacky?
A lot of his beliefs weren't wacky. You know, I mean, he was really good at doing things that, you know, George Bush, you know, never could do, which is, you know, for example, respecting expertise and knowledge and... delegating tasks to experts. You know, that was one thing he was really good at. You know, he was, you know, he had these kind of reflective qualities that was, you know, his saving grace. He had this kind of bizarre idealism, you know, that let him do things like, you know, end America's, you know, absolutely backward, you know, policy of not having any contact with China. Of course, in order to get that accomplished, he kind of reached out to a figure who was the head of Pakistan while he was committing a genocide. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's hard to find something good about Nixon without sort of finding something pretty seedy, you know, kind of not far away. But he's a major figure. He's a complex figure. And you kind of got to give your fellow Americans, you know, enough respect that if he moved that many people and inspired that many people, you got to kind of try and figure out why. You got to try and understand why. And, you know, a lot of it is demagoguery, but a lot of it isn't.
Well, I mean, I would think that I would think everybody was disappointed in Nixon, even his acolytes, in that...
For sure.
You know,
But he had no principles.
Right, and that was sort of exposed when Watergate came, which doesn't occur really in your book.
I mean, even in the case, you know, of... You know, not in the case of just, you know, just breaking the law and committing crimes and covering things up, but, you know, he would do things like he'd give a, you know, resounding statement about how wage and price controls were un-American, and then literally 2 weeks later institute wage and price controls.
Yeah.
So the conservatives weren't too pleased with that.
Which presidents since Nixon do you think are most Nixon-like or least Nixon-like, or in what way has Nixon affected them?
Oh, wow, that's pretty fascinating question. You know, I mean, one of the ways that, you know, a friend of mine wrote a book called Nixon's Shadow. It's a guy named David Greenberg, and it's about the shadow that Nixon has cast, you know, on sort of public and popular culture over the years. And, you know, the next few presidents after Nixon, certainly Ford and Carter, basically defined themselves as anti-Nixons in a very kind of deliberate way. You know, Ford was the guy who, you know, turned down the White House thermostat, and you know, Carter was the guy who got out of the limousine and said, "I will not lie to you." And Reagan, you know, his relationship to Nixon is fascinating and complex and deserves a book in itself. One of the reasons that Nixon kind of picked up on this kind of right-wing backlash politics in the '60s is because Reagan did so well with it, in the 1966 gubernatorial election. And in fact, when Reagan ran for president in 1976, very quietly, a lot of the figures who were involved high up in that campaign were actually kind of marginal Watergate figures. So he had these Nixonian qualities too. But at the same time, you know, Nixon was always this kind of figure of darkness and foreboding. And Reagan, at his most successful, always had this kind of genial, blithe kind of smile on his face. You know, I don't think there's anyone else. Well, you know, everyone has their Nixon-like qualities. I mean, you know,
I guess President Clinton. I mean,
Clinton, you know, especially I think in his, you know, sort of day-to-day following of the polls. I think, you know, George Bush in his kind of, you know, the second George Bush in his kind of l'état, c'est moi, you know, sort of, you know, imperial presidency attitude. The first George Bush very much kind of came out of the sort of Nixon kind of internationalist kind of detente foreign policy circles. I mean, he cast light, you know, on basically every politician to come after him. But because he was so, you know, resoundingly disgraced, I don't think we'll ever see anyone who considers him enough of a role model to, you know, emulate him.
Actually invoke him.
Yeah, certainly not invoke him.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he was, you know, he turned out to be, you know, his very name is an epithet in political circles.
And every president since him has had a gate of some kind.
Well, yeah, you know what, the fascinating thing about that is that was all William Safire's invention. You know, William Safire was one of his speechwriters, and he was a public relations guy before he got involved with Nixon. He wasn't involved in politics. He was like, you know, one of the guys on Mad Men,
mm-hmm.
You know. He was a Madison Avenue guy. And his job in 1966, when Nixon was making his comeback, was to basically repackage Nixon's public image. And then he became a White House speechwriter. And then he became kind of the New York Times conservative columnist because the media was, you know, terrified in the early 70s of, you know, being considered too liberal. That's when that business started. And one of the services that William Safire performed for the Republican Party was anytime any Democrat did something that was mildly scandalous, he would name it Gate. So there was Korea Gate. You know, there was Lance Gate. And what that did very subtly and very cleverly, just like the kind of flack he was trivialize Watergate,
right.
By bringing it down to the level of these, you know, minor peccadillos.
The haircut on the runway or whatever it was.
Right, you know, haircut gate. You know, it's like haircut gate suddenly becomes the functional equivalent of, you know, breaking into the Democratic National Headquarters and paying off the burglars not to squeal about it.
Now, why did you choose not to write about Watergate in your book?
Well, I'm actually working on that now.
Oh, good.
You know, so the first book I wrote goes from 58 to 64. Nixonland basically goes from 65 to 72. And the book I'm working on now is going to go from 73 to 1980. And Watergate's going to cast a huge shadow. Because for liberals, kind of coming out of Watergate and kind of having claimed Richard Nixon's scalp, this kind of culture of Woodward and Bernstein, this kind of inquisitorial culture that kind of called power to account in a very, very aggressive way, was seen as, you know, basically the route to liberal dominance. So you have someone like Senator Church, you know, from Idaho in 1975, running this very, very aggressive investigation of the CIA, you know, uncovering things like CIA assassinations, you know, uncovering things like the FBI's role in, you know, assassinating Black Panthers and things like that. And he thought that this would get him the 1976 presidential nomination. And, you know, one of the cunning paradoxes of history was that this sort of kind of post-Watergate attitude on the part of Democrats was really what kind of Ronald Reagan was reacting against with his very successful, you know, basically, don't worry, be happy, you know, you don't need to worry about any of the bad things that are going on in America, that's not the real America. And, you know, one of my kind of original arguments in this next book I'm going to be doing is, if you look at the things that Ronald Reagan actually said when Watergate was going on and when Nixon was getting impeached, when he was kind of building his national profile for his eventual presidential runs in 1976 and 1980, was, this is no big deal. You don't need to worry about this. America is the best country that ever was and always will be, and, you know, don't worry, be happy.
Do you think we're ungovernable as a result of Richard Nixon?
No, I think we're ungovernable as a result of a constitution that lets senators representing 9% of the population filibuster, representatives of 91% of the population. I mean, we're ungovernable to the extent we're ungovernable that we can't, achieve, and that's very much in the air, sort of the kind of reforms that are required to sort of succeed as a civilized nation, things like healthcare reform, because of, the Senate and the filibuster.
But so much of it has to do with it feels like it has to do with all that hate mail you got the other day.
Well, look, this is one of my important messages. Hate and anger and passion and nearly murderous rage have been part of the American political estate since there's been an America. I mean, if you think about it, the conflict at the Constitutional Convention between the slave states and the free states was more nasty and irreconcilable than anything we're dealing with today. And in fact, it led to a war in which 600,000 Americans slaughtered each other. So the idea that Americans, disagree with each other and they disagree with each other passionately, that's permanent. And I think that a politics, and I worry, a Barack Obama-like politics that says if we only can, push these conflicts aside, then we can all live together happily ever after, is kind of a childish, kind of glib politics.
Well, let me just ask you a question about your methods before we end. So what do you do? How do you do it? Do you just immerse yourself?
Immerse, yeah.
You read every magazine, watch every video? What?
Well, I try and pretend that I'm kind of like a person in the period, and what would an alert person kind of run across? So right now on my computer, as I'm doing this kind of 1973 to 1980 book, I got, 3 Days of the Condor, the movie about the CIA conspiracies in, 1976, and I got, just hundreds and hundreds of newspaper articles downloaded, and I just go to the library and search the magazines, and I go to the Museum of Television in New York and watch newscasts, and I just try to be try to reimagine what it was like to live in the time I'm writing about, and try to sort of shape it into something that has a beginning and a middle and an end.
Well, you're lucky you're not writing about medieval England then, I guess.
Couldn't do that.
Well,
my Latin sucks.
We're talking with Rick Perlstein, and his latest book, and it's a masterpiece, is called Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. And his new book, what it's going to be called?
It's going to be called The Invisible Bridge.
Well,
which is kind of my word for kind of Reagan's BS to kind of convince Americans that they didn't need to worry about anything much at all, except for hippies.
Well, I hope you'll come back and make From the Bookshelf your first stop on your next book tour.
I would be glad to.
That's great. Thank you so much for spending some time with us this week.
Take care.
That's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I do hope you enjoyed the program. Come back next week for another great show. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for making this show possible. Thanks, Breanne. And I want to thank Rick Perlstein for being my guest this week. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.